Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today, our topic is food safety, and we're talking with Patrick Guzzel, Vice President of Food Science for the National Restaurant Association. He was the keynote speaker at the recent Food Safety Conference presented by the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. We're going to talk about his personal connection to food safety, industry training and standards, creating a food safety culture, and dealing with food allergies. Patrick Guzzel has been Environmental Health Specialist in Southeastern Idaho Public Health District, Idaho Food Protection Program Manager with State's Division of Public Health, and President of Idaho Environmental Health Association. In 2018, he started the Mountain West Food Safety LLC as Adjunct Professor of Public Health at Boise State University. And he holds an MPH and MA degree in Anthropology, a BA degree in Spanish, all from Idaho State University. He and his wife, Diane, both grew up in Colorado, and they have four children, reside in Boise. Patrick Guzzel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So you guys are from Colorado, Littleton and Steamboat Springs, I'm reading.
Yeah, when I tell people that I grew up in Steamboat Springs, I also have to say that it was a very different community in the 1970s and 1980s than it is today. But yes, I grew up in Steamboat. My wife grew up in Littleton.
Yeah. So understand that you got into food safety with a very personal story, and that changed your career path. Tell me about this.
It did. So way back in 1999, I was a young man. I was I had almost completed my first master's degree, which was anthropology. And we were living in Pocatello, attending Idaho State University. And we had two little boys at the time. The oldest was three. The youngest was not quite a year old yet. And at that time, I had a night class on Thursday evenings. I think it was a Thursday. I don't remember which day it was. But there was about a two-hour break between my afternoon classes and my night classes. And I would typically find myself in a quiet corner of the building where most of my classes were. One of my professors knew that I was usually located there. And she came out, found me, and she said, "I just had a very strange phone call. Your wife called, and she said she's very sick and wants you to go home." This was before we were all carrying cell phones around. And so, yeah, I knew something was wrong because she never would have called me at school like that. So I went home and I could see that she was in fact very sick. We took her to the hospital, and my wife is a ballet instructor, and one of her students was a cardiologist in town. And as we were sitting in the lobby of the hospital there, he walked through, and my wife started to stand up, and she ended up kind of fainting into his arms. And I remember he turned around to the admittance desk and he said, "Get her into a room now." And so she got admitted right away. And at that time, it took a full three days to get the laboratory confirmation on what was causing her sickness. So the first 2 days, I didn't know what was going on. I had no understanding of why she was so sick. She was losing an awful lot of bodily fluids. She was under a great deal of pain medication that would sometimes cause her to hallucinate, and I was scared to death. I sometimes still get a little bit emotional about it. I am a practicing member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I went home that day, and I prayed like I had not prayed in a very long time. And I remember the conversation, and I said, "God, don't do this. I can't go through this. Something's wrong. I need Diane to get better." So at the beginning of day three, at the end of day two, the physician came in and he said, "I'm almost ready to make a diagnosis on this. I'm waiting for one more test." And we didn't know, he didn't tell us what test he was waiting for, but he came in on the beginning of day three and he said, "Okay, I have good news and I have bad news." He said, "The good news is I know exactly what's happening." And he said it was E. coli 0157H7. I had no understanding of what that combination of letters and numbers meant, but this is one of the strains of E. coli that can make us very, very sick. Now, to be clear, there are several different strains of E. coli. Some of them we need in our own intestinal tract. This one is one we don't want in our system. and it was making her very, very sick. But when he explained to me that it was a bacterial thing, I said, well, great, you can give her some antibiotics and she can get over this. And he said, well, that's the bad news. Typically, E. coli is not treated with antibiotics because, A, the strains that cause people to get sick are somewhat antibiotic resistant. And so what happens is if a person is on antibiotics and they're experiencing E. coli, those antibiotics can wipe out the good gut bacteria that we need and want in our system and leave the E. coli there and now be there without any competition for any resources. And it can really start to flourish that way too. So he said, what we're going to do is we're going to monitor her for the rest of the day and see what she does. And if she gets worse, then we can start to talk about some other treatment modalities. But for now, we're just going to kind of keep her hydrated and see what happens. Well, near the end of that day, she started to recover enough that by the end of day four of hospitalization, they were ready to release her and go back home. Now, my story with that ends very differently. Many, many people who experience E. coli don't have the same ending. E. coli can kill a person through complications that come around, but E. coli is a very serious microorganism that can cause a lot of serious illness up to and including death. And we don't ever want to minimize that. Well, when I got home, I called the local health department and I was told that at that time, they couldn't do a full investigation because it was an isolated case in the community. So I tried to do my own very unprofessional or investigation into it, and I came up with a few different possibilities. We had gone to a state fair a few days before she got sick. Could have been environmental exposure, but it was one isolated case in the community. There were several thousand other people that went to the fair that same day. We had gone to a restaurant, but she had ordered a dish that is typically not associated with E. coli. She ordered a boiled seafood dish. And then the third option that I cannot rule out is that it could have been something I undercooked on our grill at home. So I could have been the one responsible for that. I can't say I was, but I cannot say with any definitive truth that I know I was not the source of that either. So at that point, yeah, that changed our career. It changed our life path. I went ahead and did complete that master's degree in anthropology. And then I turned around and enrolled in a master's of public health program, specifically to get to a point where I could engage in food safety and try to help others not experience what I had experienced.
So you have a mission. You're on a mission for food safety.
I am, you can call it what you want. I am passionate about food safety. When I speak with people about food safety, and this is what I spoke about at the conference a few weeks ago, I said we all need to find our reason for why we do what we for our reason for why we do what we do. And so for me, when I think of food safety, I think of the very personal connection that I have with food safety, where I watched my wife lie in a hospital bed for 4 days, drifting in and out of consciousness and hallucinating from pain medication and losing a tremendous amount of bodily fluids. I don't need to go into details. I don't want to go into to too vivid of details, but E. coli has a couple of very specific symptoms that a person will lose an awful lot of blood as well as other body fluids. So, yeah.
As we go along here, of course, many of the principles we talk about it apply at home, right? So this for this program, do try this at home, the things that we talk about. I'm looking at some trainings that are given under the Serve Safe program. We'll get into talking about that. Maybe this can give us an overview of the problem. According to this slide, each year nearly 48 million people fall ill from foodborne illnesses. 128 million people are hospitalized. 3,000 people die from foodborne illness. 32 million in the U.S. suffer from food-related hospitalizations. 40% of illness outbreaks with known causes were at least partly associated with food contamination by a sick or infectious worker. So that's it's remains a big problem that you're dealing with.
It does. Now, those numbers that you just cited there, those are estimates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. One of the reason that they're estimates is a lot of times we don't have a full and accurate reporting of every foodborne illness that takes place. Frequently, a person might experience a foodborne illness and write it off as, well, I had the stomach flu. And really, it was probably a foodborne illness of some kind. But we don't call the local health department, or we don't call our local physician or our family physician and undergo a series of tests to help identify exactly what was going on. And then frequently, with a couple of these illnesses, sometimes they'll pass through us relatively quickly, and the next day we might start to feel better. And so we think, oh, I'm okay. I don't need to worry about going to the doctor again or anything else like that. And so that's really why those numbers are estimates. And yeah, with the National Restaurant Association, we do provide a series of trainings. Actually, we work closely with the state restaurant associations. And so the Utah Restaurant Association in Utah works very closely with a lot of with their restaurants throughout the state to provide training, to provide resources to make sure that managers and employees of food establishments understand the risk that we were just talking about with some of those numbers and why it's so important to have training. And so, yeah, we work closely with every state's restaurant association, but Utah Restaurant Association in particular for Utah.
So you've been with the Southeastern Idaho Public Health District, also with the state's Division of Public Health, a couple of places you've worked, president of the Idaho Environmental Health Association. This, I guess, is with other problems you deal with through regulation, I imagine, but also training, communication. How do you attack this?
Yeah, so when I worked for the local health department and the state health department in Idaho, we were really focused on, yeah, education and training. And that we would do that in conjunction with the inspections that we would do. And I know a lot of regulators around the country. I know many of the Utah regulators, and I know they have a similar approach. They want to educate people in the restaurant about the risks of foodborne illness. And as they explain it, it helps to understand that's why the rule says what it says. We have a rule, for example, most states have a rule that, you can't use your bare hands when you contact certain foods. You have to wash your hands a certain number of after certain work that you do in the kitchen. And as we educate folks about that, hopefully they start to understand the why that rule is in place, and that kind of helps drive the concept of food safety culture then.
Let's get into some, I guess, some tips, some parts of the training that can be useful, not only to reassure us as we go to restaurants,
Yeah.
but in our home, right? Home cooking. So I know temperature is a part of that. Cleanliness. Tell us a few tips.
Yeah, I've had a lot of conversations with people that ask me about the differences. Do I need to be as strict at home as we train people to do in restaurants? And my blanket statement there is that you probably have a much better idea of who is coming into your home than the restaurant does. The restaurant is open their doors to everybody. Your home probably is not open to everybody. And so you have a little bit better idea of who's coming into your home. But some of the concepts still are, we do need to be just as strict. We need to make sure we wash our hands. There's a process called cross-contamination where we want to make sure if we're cutting up raw chicken on a cutting board, that we then wash and rinse and sanitize that cutting board before we cut up lettuce, which is not going to be cooked, or in other raw meats like that. We want to prevent any kinds of cross-contamination. You mentioned temperature. We want to make sure that we're cooking foods to an appropriate temperature, that when we're done with the foods, that we put the leftovers in our refrigerator again at an appropriate temperature that will help to control for that bacterial growth. And again, the ServSafe training covers a lot of this. And again, Utah Restaurant Association does a great job in helping restaurants with that ServSafe training.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll talk about creating a culture of food safety.
Okay.
We're talking with Patrick Guzzel, who is the Vice President of Food Science for the National Restaurant Association. He recently was the keynote speaker at the Food Safety Conference just a couple of weeks ago, presented by the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. More following this brief break.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. This week in E-Town, we are kicking off our 35th anniversary season with part one of our 35th special. It's including some great music from people like Steve Earle and Guy Clark and Sean Colvin and J.J. Cale and Bob Weir and the Blind Boys of Alabama and much more. That's this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on UPR.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and Cafe Ibis, 52 Federal Avenue in historic downtown Logan. Open 7 days a week, featuring triple-certified bird-friendly coffee, espresso bar, beans brewing tools, and many gift options. Information and ordering at cafeibis.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our topic today is food safety. We're talking with Patrick Uzzell, Vice President of Food Science for the National Restaurant Association. He's done food safety on the regional level, state level, national level, and he also is an adjunct professor of public health at Boise State University. Patrick Uzzell, before we get into creating a food safe culture, I want to talk a little bit about food regulators. You've been, as I mentioned, at various levels with this, and you've got all sorts of businesses. You got the big restaurants, you got the, I guess, the franchise chains, but you also got the little, you know, pop up food trucks and your one off things at the county fair. I guess as a food regulator, you're responsible for all of that.
You are, yeah, and they're all held to the same standards. Now sometimes those standards can be modified a little bit, but like a mobile food truck, for example, that you mentioned, they should have all of the same equipment in there that is in the back of a kitchen of a restaurant. It might just be a little bit smaller in scale, but it's going to be there too.
Yeah. What sorts of equipment is needed for food safety?
Yeah, the one of the biggest things we'll always look for is a hand washing sink that's got hot and cold running water. Soap and paper towels are available. And then from there, we can kind of look at the menu and determine, you know, what kind of foods are on your menu. If it's a what we call a cook and serve, of course, you need the cooking surface. You're going to need cold holding equipment to hold your raw materials. If you're holding the food, you're going to need hot holding equipment. It's got to be held at a temperature that doesn't allow any bacteria to grow in it. So those are kinds of some of the things that we will look for. Those are minimums. We've also got to make sure there's an ability to wash, rinse, and sanitize your dishes. So in most places, that will be either some kind of a mechanical dishwasher, a commercial-grade dishwasher, or a three-compartment sink. A lot of times, we'll require both because sometimes those dishwashers will break down, or we've got big pieces of equipment that don't fit in a dishwasher. So we got to get it submerged into a three-compartment sink to make sure we still get it rinsed and washed, rinsed, and sanitized appropriately. So those are some of the minimums that we'll look for.
Are there, I'm curious about national trends, world trends. Are there new foodborne illnesses popping up that you have to worry about?
That's a great question. I don't know so much that there's new illnesses popping up as much as it's that we have a much better ability to detect some of the illnesses that we have seen in the past. Medical diagnostic tools are rapidly improving every single day. There's new improvements with medical diagnostics. And because of that, we're able to diagnose more quickly and we're able to diagnose more certainly what might be going on if a person is presenting with some of the common symptoms of foodborne illness.
Let's talk about creating a culture of food safety. You work with this in training. Give me a few pointers from that training.
Yeah, our recent we recently updated our to our ninth edition of ServSafe, and in that ninth edition, we talk a little bit about food safety culture. This is a trend or a discussion item that's been going on in the food safety world for about the last 20 years or so. And really simply what it means is we all have a culture. Our culture is just kind of typical of how we normally do things. You know, in the Intermountain West, we've got certain cultures that we do. If I go to, I do a lot of travel for work. I'm actually in Orlando, Florida today. There are things that if I were to say the what I would typically say in Boise, Idaho, they might look at me a little bit funny here in Orlando, Florida. Common example, I grew up, you know, the wood stuff that we stack things on at a big box store, those are called pallets, right? Well, in the East, they're called skids. And so, when I first started coming to the East, I started talking about pallets and people would look at me like, what are you talking about? So this is all part of our culture. Now, when we apply that to food safety, our food safety culture is just what we normally do on an everyday basis. It's our ingrained habits. It's the things that we do so frequently that we get to a point where we don't really even have to think about them. So for example, if I walk into a kitchen, and I did this as an inspector, and I still do it today. If I walk into a restaurant kitchen, before I go to look at anything, before I even ask any questions, the very first thing I do is I find the closest hand washing sink and I wash my hands. That's just habit now. That's part of our food safety culture. Another element of our food safety culture, I can't disclose names of restaurants, but you know, I know of a lot of restaurants that when you go in and you order a particular protein, maybe you like a nice seafood item, as they pull it off the grill, they'll check it with a thermometer before they put it on the plate to ensure that it's at the appropriate temperature. Same with chicken, steak, same like that. They're going to check, many restaurants will check it with a thermometer before they put it on your plate. That's part of their culture. That's just their normal practices of what they do. And so that's really, when we talk about a food safety culture, it's really just about taking the steps that become part of our ingrained habits of what we normally do. And that's just part of who we are now.
It's my impression that generally, you know, restaurants, et cetera, are pretty safe. I guess the regulation, the training generally works.
Yeah, absolutely it does. I equate it to, airline travel. You know, every single day around the world, thousands of flights safely take off and land every single day. And every single day, there are millions of delicious meals that are prepared in restaurants and safely served. Sometimes something won't quite go right, and we can end up causing people to be sick, even though we never wanted it to happen. It can happen. And those are the ones that make the news. And those are the ones that we then have to step back and rethink our food safety culture. Did we do something that could have been prevented? Was there something we could have done better in those situations? And that's what we're trying to do.
Hmm. If you just joined us, we're talking with Patrick Guzzel. He is the Vice President of Food Science for the National Restaurant Association. He's been involved in food safety for his whole career. He gave the keynote address at the recent food safety conference in Utah. I'd like to transition now talking about food allergies. I pulled up a presentation you gave. This was two or three or four years ago. Very, very interesting to me. I don't myself deal with food allergies, but I know people who do, and it can be it can be very stressful. In fact, in this presentation, you quote a parent who says it's emotionally exhausting, never out of my mind, talking about their child with food allergies.
I remember that. And I was privileged to speak at a webinar that was offered by an organization called FAIR, an organization that works to educate people about food allergies. We have an adult, he's an adult now. One of our sons deals with a fairly severe food allergy. And my wife deals with a couple of food allergies that are kind of uncommon, but she deals with some food allergies. And it's something that we think about. It's something that my son thinks about. He has a severe tree nut allergy. And whenever he's out at a restaurant, he will ask, you know, are there any nuts in this particular dish that he might be looking at? It particularly becomes an issue with some of the desserts that he looks at. And he's had situations where he's been told, no, there's no nuts in there, but it turns out there were some nuts somewhere because he experienced a reaction. And, you know, he's been able to be okay all these times. But like that parent that's quoted, I remember when he was younger. Yeah, it was something we thought about all the time. Are there any nuts in this particular item that he's going to be eating?
I'm not sure if your son, somebody mentioned the presentation, talked about that there was a dessert you wouldn't normally think of having nuts in it. They found out later that it was had a Nutella base.
Yeah, that was my son. Mm-hmm. That was my son. He had been served a chocolate mousse at a banquet that he had went to, and you know, he was told, no, there's no nuts, and he looks at it, and sure enough, there's no nuts. But you know, I mean, it looks like it's a chocolate pudding if you're familiar with Nutella, and it was, for the most part, it was a chocolate pudding, but it also had some Nutella in it, and of course, Nutella is a hazelnut product, and so he experienced a reaction. Yeah.
I think I'm hearing more lately about food allergies. Are there more in total number, or are we just detecting them more?
Again, I think it's a matter of improved detection. I think that, again, because of the advances that have been made with medical diagnostics over the last several years, that we just have that much better of an ability to diagnose a food allergy sooner than we ever had in the past.
In this presentation, you give a couple of tragic examples. There was a gentleman who ordered, I think it was a chicken breast. And you wouldn't think of that causing a problem.
That was a few years ago that happened in the United Kingdom. And I don't know the full details of the story. I saw it reported in a major newspaper. I don't remember off the top of my head which newspaper I saw it in. But yeah, what had happened is apparently that chicken breast had been dipped into, it was like a breaded chicken breast, but to keep the breading adhere to the meat, they dipped it into buttermilk and then put their coating on it and then cooked it and served it. And in that situation, it was very tragic. That young man did not survive. He had a very severe allergy to milk, and you know, he did not survive.
There's another young lady had a nut allergy, I think. The dessert kind of had a hidden quantity.
Yeah, that was a situation that happened. It happened to a family in a suburb of Boise, Idaho. The young lady, if I understand the details correctly, she was at a cheerleading event, and similar to my son, they went to a group dinner, and she was exposed to some tree nuts with one of the ingredients in one of the dishes at that dinner, and you know, again, she didn't survive that. A very tragic situation.
Now, you talk about food allergies versus food sensitivities. What's the difference?
Yeah, the main difference is food allergy is usually caused by a protein that causes your body to go into some kind of an anaphylactic reaction. A food sensitivity, we often associate with a food allergy, and it may not be an authentic food allergy. I have a good friend who is also in the food safety world, and he frequently says that he's allergic to jalapenos. And it's like, yeah, I don't know, maybe that's a sensitivity. Now, I never argue with a person. If they say they have a food allergy, I say, great, thank you for telling me. And we'll treat it with extra care that we should, because some of these food allergies can be very severe.
So to treat them essentially the same, I guess what you're saying. Yeah.
My advice is to treat it like it's the same, even though you never want to argue with somebody. And if they say they have a food allergy, just don't have the debate. Just say, okay, thank you for telling me. There's no reason to have a debate about whether it's an allergy or a sensitivity or anything like that. It's treat it with extra care.
Yeah. You've mentioned your wife. She has very unusual food allergy.
She does. She has a couple of very unusual food allergies. First of all, she is allergic to poultry protein. So not just eggs, but actual poultry protein. So she can't eat chicken. She can't eat turkey. She can't eat anything like that. And that includes in the base of a soup. So we have to think about, you know, when we go to a restaurant, if she wants a soup, we have to ask what is the base of the soup. If there's with food allergies, we call the process I mentioned earlier cross-contamination. The process with a food allergy is called cross-contact. So we'll go to some restaurant sometimes and they might get in a hurry and there might be some cross contact between poultry and other products that she can eat and that she's ordering off the menu. So we have to be careful with that. The one that's really unusual is she's allergic to a coloring called carmine or cochineal extract. This is a coloring that puts a nice, bright, vibrant red into foods. It is considered a natural coloring. But it does have to be identified on a label. But she is, because of that, there are some pharmaceutical companies that use carmine in some medications. And so she can't take that particular medication because she's allergic to one of the sub ingredients that has colored that medicine to be a nice vibrant red or something.
So in this presentation, I found it very interesting. You, in terms of saying what restaurants and other providers should do about food allergies, you mentioned Disney resorts and garbage cans. That was a very interesting analogy. I don't know if you remember that one. Also, Titanic lifeboats. I thought it was interesting you brought those in.
Yeah. So when I talk about food safety, it's a very dry topic. I try to put it into real life terms that people can understand and relate to. So if you've ever been at a Disney property, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that at a Disney property that Walt Disney never wanted to be more than, I think it was 19 or 20 steps away from a garbage can or something like that. So if you're on a Disney property, allegedly still, you're never going to be more than 19 or 20-ish steps away from a garbage can. And that's one of the reasons that those parts are able to be maintained so clean. And then the Titanic example is interesting to me because I often hear people say, well, you know, we've met the government standard. We've met what the food code says. And I applaud those efforts. Now, in ServSafe and other training, we talk about, you know, you need to think about let's take a couple of extra steps here too. So I often bring up the Titanic. A lot of people don't realize Titanic, and we know how this story ends, but Titanic had sufficient lifeboats on board according to the maritime laws at that time. They met the maritime laws of the time, but we know how that story ends. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Overall, it can be a problem. For example, that tragic example of the chicken breast in England, UK. Mm-hmm. I think the gentleman had communicated, "Yeah, I've got milk allergies." Somehow that didn't get back to the staff. That the communication is a big factor,
right? And so going back to the training elements. This is where something like a ServSafe training is so important because in that training, we talk about how everybody needs to understand the communication protocols here. If the server is told, I have a food allergy, that message absolutely has to make sure it gets into the kitchen too, so that the kitchen people, the people actually preparing the food, are aware that they're dealing with a food allergy on a particular check. And then they can take the appropriate steps they need to in the kitchen to avoid any kind of cross contact taking place.
What about menu? I think there has been a development of symbols, certain symbols you could put on the menu.
Yes, there are. There are some internationally recognized symbols for allergens, and we ServSafe provides them. Other companies can provide those. I was in Europe a few years ago with my wife, and we noticed on European menus where we were in Europe, a lot of the restaurants, almost every restaurant now that I think of it, had the picture symbols on their menus of what kinds of food allergies were in each of those different dishes. Here in the United States, you might see a trend where people, servers specifically, are asking, as a guest is seated, they might ask, are there any food allergies at the table that I need to be aware of? Or another big trend that we're seeing is in restaurants, many of them are disclosing allergens on their menu, or they're putting like their website on a menu or a QR code that a person can scan and pull up the menu on their smartphone, for example, and they can see the different ingredients that go into a particular menu item. And then that person, you know, can decide, especially if the person knows if it's a sensitivity versus an allergy, they can then decide, do I still want to consume this product, or maybe I want to choose something different on the menu.
You mentioned this is typical and understandable. Some restaurants put a disclaimer on there. You can tell they've talked to their lawyers with this. And again, understandable. Some of those are pretty sweeping. We're not responsible for anything kind of a statement. What do you suggest restaurants do?
You know, I recognize both sides of this debate. I understand why a restaurant might choose to just put that item on their menu. As a food safety expert, I would recommend taking an extra step and just, you know, being a little more specific than just those broad general statements that say, you know, for example, all of our foods have been exposed to allergens. Now that's just, I'm making that up. I don't know if any restaurants say anything like that, but I would recommend including more specific information. And if there's a matter of space on the menu and not being able to do it, that's why some folks are just putting a web address on the menu or a QR code that a person can then scan and they can look at that information through other mechanisms. So,
what about the other side of this? To say a person has food allergies, you're going to a restaurant. What is your responsibility? What are some things you can do to help with your safety?
Yeah, if you have a food allergy, the biggest thing you can do is communicate that with the restaurant staff and say, and especially with the improvements that we've had in training over the last several years, many restaurant staff members are now more and more aware of food allergies and the potential for concerns there. And so if I'm a guest and I walk into a restaurant, I can say, hey, listen, I've got an allergy to this and this or whatever it is as I'm being seated. And then that server can help me with the menu, can say, okay, well, you know, you need to avoid this particular dish, but here are some other things that you can choose that don't have those ingredients in there. Mm.
What about if you're not a professional operation? I think this was your son, if I remember correctly, is scout camp or something. He has a nut allergy, right?
I had forgotten about that one. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he was, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old, he was working at a scout camp. And it was in a very remote area of Idaho. And he called us one day from the satellite phone that the scout camp had. And he said, Mom and Dad, I just want you to know, I really like the taste of walnuts. And we were both, what? Where did you get walnuts? Because we knew his allergy, you know. Well, it turns out that he had had a cinnamon roll. And at some point during the day, it was on a common table. And it had a sign in front of it. These contain walnuts. But either that sign had gotten removed or it had gotten knocked over or something. The sign wasn't visible to our son. And so he picked up one of those cinnamon rolls and he took a few bites of it. And he realized, you know, pretty quickly that he was having that anaphylactic reaction in his mouth and in his throat. So he ran off to the camp nurse and they were able to help him out. He had an EpiPen with him and, you know, he was able to use his EpiPen and then he took a bunch of Benadryl. He had been exposed at an earlier time in his life to walnuts. And that one, we had taken him to the hospital in town and they had given him several doses of Benadryl. So he knew that he was okay to do that. And so at the scout camp, he gave himself several Benadryl tablets and then slept for 2.5 days or something. I don't remember the number of days. He said he'd slept quite a while he was just coming out of it and he thought he'd give us a call. He was fine. And, you know, he obviously recovered. He lives in Kansas City with his wife now. And but he got lucky on that. It could have been a lot worse than it was.
You mentioned cross-contamination and that's something I think everybody needs to be careful with. You have had a photo in your presentation that really struck me, a worker cleaning off the table after, you know, between customers, there's a little bit of peanut butter there, and the worker appears to be just be wiping it off. I guess more you should, you know, sanitize that.
Right. And we were seeing this a lot, especially during the COVID pandemic. People were really being careful with tabletops and other surfaces in restaurants. But yeah, I remember that picture that you're talking about. And so, yeah, our advice in a situation like that is just make sure you're actually going through that wash, rinse, and sanitize process on a tabletop or other surface where there might be some food allergy concerns. There was some peanut butter in that particular picture.
Well, just in general, taking this back to maybe the private sector, just, you know, you're throwing a picnic or you're at a scout event or whatever it might be, tips for folks on both sides of this to keep your folks safe from food allergies.
With allergies, you know, the main thing is just communicate. If you have people who are going to be attending a family event or something like that, ask them, do you have any food allergies? Especially if you don't know the people very well. Now, if they're your close family, you should probably be aware of their allergies anyway. But if you're not, go ahead and ask the question. If you're the guest, go ahead and tell the host, say, hey, I have a food allergy. I just want you to be aware of it. And so they can kind of take the necessary precautions there. It really comes down, in my opinion, a big assistance with food allergies all comes down to communications.
Just a couple minutes left in the conversation. I do want to just have you mention briefly that I was, you know, searching the internet, you know, Google Patrick Guzzle, and interesting things come up. You did a presentation on ghost kitchens. You were part of a ghost kitchen panel. That struck my imagination. What's a ghost kitchen?
Yeah, I remember that. We were seeing ghost kitchens, what are called ghost kitchens, during the height of the pandemic. And they are still used in some cases, but what these are is basically it's a kitchen that might even carry a national name brand that doesn't have a front facing interface for the customer. Oftentimes they're used to help support delivery service. So again, I know of a particular restaurant that still uses ghost kitchens frequently. They get a lot of requests for delivery of their food. Well, their parking lots are also very busy areas, and they don't want their delivery, especially third-party deliveries or other delivery companies, they don't want those guys and gals to be coming into the parking lot frequently, especially when there might be little children in that same parking lot. So they will use a ghost kitchen, and they direct the delivery companies use this location. It's the same food as it was at the brick-and-mortar store. It's the same menu. It's the same everything. They just divert some of those delivery drivers to a different location to avoid any kind of concerns with safety and traffic in their parking lot.
Yeah.
Now, in some locations are called different terms, but ghost kitchen is a pretty well-known term in the regulatory world now.
So finally, into the conversation here, what would you want people to take away from a conversation about food safety?
You know, my biggest takeaway is we at National Restaurant Association, we do represent ServSafe. The state restaurant associations that we work with also have a lot of wonderful resources for ServSafe and for a lot of other tools that can really help a person be successful in a food service career. And so for your folks here there in Utah, I would highly encourage them to check out the Utah Restaurant Association and the resources that they have available right there in the state of Utah.
All right, we've been talking with Patrick Guzzle, the Vice President of Food Science for the National Restaurant Association. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. After the gold rush. In the sky, well, should the walls push in to suffocate you? Should the life you've been leading gotta go, well, get out in the morning. Look for sparkly Vega in the early light. That's right, in the morning, overhead. Try tracking her before sunrise. follow with binoculars across the sky into the daylight. Kind of cool. In the evening, the spring arch of magical stars and orbs is quite thought-provoking and emotive in the high west. After dusk, with a lineup stretching from the south to the north, Jupiter still hangs below the Gemini twins and Orion starts to go over the horizon, so grab some last glimpses here. The Lyrid meteor shower has begun with a crest on the 21st of April, so we'll need to get out of town really to see this one going on after midnight up to dawn. Keep an eye out for Comet Pan stars, which may be visible in binoculars, possibly even with the naked eye during the early mornings this week. A rare long period comet returns after 170,000 years low on the eastern horizon just before sunrise. And for dessert on Sunday, April 19th, the moon meets the Pleiades. A slender crescent moon pairs beautifully with the seven sisters, making a lovely naked eye binocular sight. You don't need the binoculars, but it'll help. And our big space launch, and I mean major, Artemis II, completed its mission with flying colors from the launch to the orbital insertion around Earth to translunar injection, which means firing the thrusters for our crew to go out and around the moon and past it, taking some new photos, witnessing a solar eclipse from way out there and its way around back toward the Earth with beautiful photographs. The reentry went well, or we wouldn't have astronauts to talk to. Fine work from NASA and the engineers. The heat shields worked amazingly. Crew and NASA administrators as well. Next hurdles for Congress to stop the administration's draconian cuts to NASA despite its success. 47% cuts proposed by the you-know-who. These would give deep space probes such as Juno and Psyche and many, many others already on the way to study possible life-giving environments on the moons of Jupiter and so much more. It's up to Congress to save NASA as it did last year and us. So write your congressman or someone else's. And speaking of Juno, let's get an update on our Intrepid spacecraft on the way out to check out Jupiter's moons, checking for water under the ice of Europa. After enduring a five-year, 1.7 billion-mile journey from Earth and evading showers of the most punishing radiation outside the sun, Juno has provided breathtaking images and providing discoveries from Jupiter and its moons and in their quest to engage and inspire the public. Since it arrived in Jupiter in 2016, Juno spacecraft has been probing beneath dense, forbidding clouds encircling the giant planet. The first orbiter to appear so closely is looking to answer questions about the origin and evolution of Jupiter. And evidence suggests that ingredients underneath Europa for life may exist in the saltwater ocean beneath that icy shell of Europa. Evidence suggests that the ingredients for life may exist in the saltwater ocean that lies beneath Europa's icy shell. It's One Sky, Many Cultures on Leo T. Let's get under the ocean for this one and think about the seahorse. From Susan Seydenboulay and Pomegranate Communications, seahorse is a symbol of power. This unique animal is associated with valor and bravery. It was a steed of the Greek god Neptune, or Poseidon, the ruler of the sea. Neptune was frequently depicted amid huge curling waves in a chariot pulled by great seahorses. The seahorse's ability to negotiate the rolling seas, a symbol of physical and spiritual transformation, signifies its role as a guide in times of change. See the beautiful interpretation from Susan's painting on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page and keep looking deep. Look around and get just a little bit lost in space and time. Skywatcher Leo T.